Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books, and we interview the authors of those books. And this week, I'm happy to say we have Douglas Rushkoff on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. As some of you who listen to this show know, I am by training a historian, so this book frightened the pants off me because Doug basically says that the past is disappearing, and then I would be out of a job. As if, yeah. So that's sort of disturbing for me. So, Doug, this is a frightening book for me. So, welcome to the show.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Absolutely. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name's Doug Rushkoff. I'm a media theorist by trade. I was originally a theater director and then became interested in kind of multimedia opportunities and why people that I knew from my youth were getting involved in computer technology in the mid-80s and late-80s, and I got involved in the whole internet thing and got very excited by the promise of the net, especially the dream of everybody working at home in their underwear in their own time. And then I kind of watched as the internet as a social phenomenon became the internet as .com boom and the salvation of the Nasdaq stock exchange, and human attention seemed to become the new commodity. And instead of using this stuff to make more time and less work for ourselves, it seemed that we were using the net to make less time and more work for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that really kind of led me to start thinking about the issues that I talk about in Present Shock.
Yeah, that's a nice segue into my next question, which you know, and that is, why did you write this book? What really spurred you to write it?
A few things. I mean, one was my the shift in my own perception of time and time availability. In a very topical sense, just the way the net distracts us and our attention gets divided between all these different things, and hours and days seem to go by. And when have you last touched ground and looked into people's eyes and experienced sort of organic group cohesion and things like that? So that was on my mind in sort of an immediate way. But I've had a very kind of a long standing, I've been investigating the way we sort of organize reality temporally. I've been very interested in stories and the way that Aristotle looks at stories having beginnings, middles, and ends. I was a theater director, so I was really interested in temporal experiences and in how stories and values and things are conveyed over time. And when are people in charge of their time, and when are they kind of thrown out of time? In other words, what are the different ways that persuasive individuals and institutions kind of throw us out of human time in order to convince us of things, in order to unsettle us, in order to induce regression and transference and things like that. So, I mean, I've for a very long time, I've been interested in sort of the relationship of what we might call chronos and kairos, the two Greek notions of time, time of the clock, which is chronos, and then human time, which is kairos. And how do the different ways in which we define chronos historically, and how have those changed the relationship of people to the powerful institutions in their society, and what might understanding these things do to help us kind of get the upper hand on our would-be controllers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think a lot about time myself, again, as a historian, and I used to live in the 16th century, at least a lot of my friends would claim that. So I studied vast swathes of time, and now I don't really do that anymore, and I think I'm, as you say in the book, sort of trapped in the present. The book is divided into a number of sections, and I think the best way to convey what's in it is actually to go through them. In the first one, you talk about narrative, that is stories, and how narratives have been collapsed. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, really simply, a device like a remote control or a DVR, you know, changes the way, it changes our ability to move through a story in our own way. Whereas, you know, our dad touches it on the couch and watch a television program or a commercial from beginning, middle to end, you know, we can escape the captive spell of the narrator, you know, anyhow we want. You know, by just changing the channel, we can leave. So they no longer have a captive audience, and they have a lot more of a challenge trying to bring us through a traditional narrative arc the way they might have been able to do before. You know, they need, just like Shakespeare did at the beginning of his plays, when he would say, "Oh, pardon, gentles, all of it. Mm-hmm. We would presume to do this to you. Please forgive us." You know, it's really the same thing now. They have to really get our permission. You know, we have to voluntarily surrender authority over our time to them. And people are much less likely and willing to do that. So we start to see our entertainment really change from sort of these linear arcs with beginnings, middles, and ends to things that intended to have much more either immediate or even, you know, what we might call atemporal modes of communication. So you watch something like The Simpsons, where it's much less about beginning, middle, and end. Will Homer get out of the nuclear power plant before it blows up? You know, that matters much less than the sort of the moment-to-moment connections that we're making between things. Oh, this scene is a satire of that commercial, and this scene is a satire of that. And so we're making connections in real time as we go through this experience, rather than looking toward the future. Or a political movement today will have a whole lot less to do with keeping our eyes on the prize and the long march toward a particular goal, and have much more to do with you know, what are we doing right now? How is this process changing us or changing the world? It's you know, very much like, say, you know, the Occupy movement, which is really a presence-based movement. They're much less concerned with their long-term goals than they are with their, you know, processes, what they're doing right now to reach a consensus.
I always kind of think of it, well, after reading your book, I had thought of this before, but I think the media have become kind of a highlight reel. Because I remember when I used to play a lot of basketball and watch it in the 80s, and I remember when the highlight reel first appeared. I'm like, oh, this is great. You get to watch all the best plays. You don't watch any game, you just watch the best plays. And
Exactly. I used to think about that in terms of Broadway. It's like you go see Jerome Robbins' Broadway. It was this musical reviewer that was basically the last song of every Jerome Robbins musical. So there's just these kick lines, climax. It's like, oh my God. You know, so there's no song. It's not like some Neil Young song that has a beginning, middle, and then bam. You know, or you know, it's funny, Steve Soderbergh mentioned this book. He was on a plane ride, apparently, and he saw the guy pull out an iPad and start watching a movie on the iPad, and then he realized the guy wasn't watching a movie. He was watching the action scenes and explosions of a whole bunch of movies all strung together. He was like, oh my God, that's present shock. I get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So then, you know, another thing that occurred to me is the way my 5-year-old son thinks about narrative, and he thinks about it in terms of levels in computer games. That's his sort of understanding of it. I'm on level 6 now. I'm going to get to level 7. Yeah, that's his understanding of story.
Again, video games are real-time narrative, right?
Yeah,
you are the protagonist. You're not watching some story that's happened to somebody else at some point in time. You are living a story in real-time in a choice-to-choice fashion.
That's interesting. Do you think this is bad, that we've lost narrative in this way?
Good things and bad things about it. I mean, it's good in that we've released ourselves from the narrative captive spell of storytellers who may not have our best interests at heart. It's bad in that we no longer have this very particularly effective means of generating solidarity and conveying values over time.
I guess I think about it to harken back to what you said. I think Aristotle would not like it, but I think Plato would love it, because he really didn't like drama very much.
Yeah, there you go.
He hated stories.
Yeah.
He thought they corrupted you. So,
yeah,
so that's
he would have said it was all decadent anyway. Yeah,
so we have a new kind of Neoplatonism in action. So let's move on to the second part, and that is digiphrenia. And this is the one that really that I really identified with. That is the what you describe as, this is my own words, but the sort of desire to be someplace else while you're someplace, to be always be someplace else. And I see this everywhere now.
Exactly. You know, in the sort of the video game logic that we were talking about before, when you move from choice to choice to choice to choice, you know, we live in a world that says, well, you don't have to choose. You can choose both. You know, so you can choose to be here and there at the same time. Mm-hmm. You can have more than one. I mean, it's not enough to pay attention to something like it was in the old days. Now you have to pay attention to two different things at the same time or have multiple identities simultaneously consuming and producing. You know, so you've got you on Facebook and you on Twitter and you on Tumblr and you on Instagram, all these identities. And they're actually doing things on your behalf when you're not even there. You know, Mark Zuckerberg is advertising with your picture, you know, and you are endorsing things that you may never have heard of while you're asleep. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're going to wake up and you're going to have to answer for that the next day. Mm-hmm. So digiphrenia really is that. It's that that sense of mental confusion, you know, that comes with trying to be in more than one place at the same time.
Yeah. And this has become totally ubiquitous in places that I would have thought 10, 15 years ago, it would not have been. So, for example, in my family, we will get together occasionally, and half of the people there will be looking at their cell phones while we are together. I mean, this used to be very unusual. You'd see people at a cafe with two cell phones, and you'd be, that's very odd, but now it's extraordinarily common. You go to a cafe
I have strict rules about it in my house. I mean, I'm obviously online. I'm a pro-technology person, but at dinner, it's like, no, these devices are up unless, you know, grandma's dying.
Right.
We're not going to pick up the phone. I remember the New York Times review, which is great, rave review for this book, kind of a life-changing review came in, and we're at dinner. Cell phone starts vibrating, the phone starts ringing, everything starts pinging, and I'm like, I'm not getting up, we're not getting up, we are not answering it. Then we hear the phone, that someone's leaving a message on the phone machine, oh my God, you got this review, oh my God, have you seen this thing? And my wife's like, you can check the computer, it's okay. I'm like, no, I'm not going to read that, I'm not going to look at that computer until after dinner.
I tried to fight this battle in my own family, and that is my extended family, and I basically just lost. I just realized I would be a pariah if I insisted on this in my own house. So I don't do it. You know, I really don't. And I used to tell people that, you know, I lost my cell phone for 6 months. You really can't lose your cell phone for 6 months. I chose not to have a cell phone for 6 months, and it was a nice time. But now I have young kids.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is you lose a device like that. You do something like that. You actually end up better and more coherent, more grounded.
Yeah,
you actually end up more highly functional. When you are exercising autonomy and agency over your use of these things,
right,
than when you passively accept the way they come at you.
Right. Well, I was just in another kind of family incident. I was told recently, I sometimes turn it off when I'm doing something like playing with the kids. And I was told in no uncertain terms by somebody who really wanted to get a hold of me not to do that anymore. I'm sorry. I think it's kind of a generational thing because the person that said this is younger than I am. And I grew up without any of this stuff. So, go outside and come back when the streetlights come on. So I find it astounding. I mean, I remember I used to be a kind of a dean at a university, and I had, I was managing like 600 undergraduates. And I used to eat with them in the dining hall, and I made a rule, no cell phones. And it was very clear after about a month that was just a totally lost cause, that the tide was coming in, and I couldn't do anything about it. I couldn't enforce it.
Right.
So, yeah, it just was impossible. There you go. So let's go on to the next one. I think it's the next one. We're recalling all this now. Overwinding. What is overwinding?
Right.
Yeah.
Overwinding is just when, you know, if you live in a timeless reality, there's still people trying to pack huge wads of time into teeny little moments. It's sort of the way in the stock market where people, you don't buy something in order to invest in some future. You're not buying a stock in order for it to go up a year or two or five from now. You're buying a stock to make money on the trade. You know, Facebook launched and people bought it in the morning and they were upset 10 minutes later when the stock hadn't gone up and they all sold it and called it a failure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people, if they're not happy buying the stock now, so then they'll buy a derivative of the stock, which is literally that stock 30 days in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Then if they're not satisfied with that, then they buy a derivative of that derivative, which is a derivative 30 days in the future. So there's all this temporal compression going in. It gets to the point where the derivatives market, where this temporally compressed market is bigger than the real one. You know, the New York Stock Exchange was actually purchased by the derivatives exchange.
Mm-hmm.
That means the New York Stock Exchange was consumed by its own temporal abstraction, which is just absurd. Mm-hmm. But it just goes to show you that the overwhelmed market, you know, and the overwhelmed reality, this reality of temporal compression, is becoming bigger and weightier than the reality of time passing in the way it actually does.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess I think, again, this was very interesting to me as a historian, because historians talk about, I guess we would call them factors that operate in the very long term that affect almost everything. These have just been lost completely in the kind of rush of data about moments. And people are willing to attribute causality to things which are sort of surface events. They don't really, they contribute to things, but they're not causing things. And I just
felt, yeah, that is fascinating. There's sort of these long tail effects of things. Like the one that I keep looking at is the invention of central currency. You know, and something ends up, you know, sitting there as the status quo, you know, unit of exchange for so long. We forget that it was an invention.
Yeah.
You know, that it was invented at a very particular moment in history. It was very particular embedded biases that may or not be serving people today, and they forget that there were other tools. They forget, you know. So, and that's another really symptom of present shock, that we're so kind of, in a sense, lost in this thing that we think is the present moment, that we, you know, become incapable of doing, you know, appropriate critical analysis of the underlying landscape and the institutions that we're accepting as reality.
Mm-hmm. And I think the underlying assumption of overwinding really is that the world is so insecure as to be kind of anxiety making all the time, that nothing is stable. Everything is changing all the time. Now, this is, you know, a Buddhist would tell you this is true, but it is kind of nervous making to, you know, I'm reminded of the advice that your broker or the person at who manages your money, he always says, look, we're going to invest your money. Or she says, we're going to invest your money. Don't look at it. Nobody does that.
Right.
Nobody can do that.
Yeah.
You know, you know, you have this screen, you can just pop it up. You can see how your money markets did that day. And so you're constantly engaged in this thing. You don't feel stable. You're like, you lose it at any moment. And
yeah, but the also reason they tell you to invest your money and not look at it is because you invest your money and it goes down.
Yeah.
I had my money with one of these guys, you know, and it's like 15 years later. So I'm being diligent. I'm not looking at it. You know, I do it once, like 5 years later, there's less money than there was when I started.
Yeah.
Do it again, 10 years later, there's no more money than I put in. And
yeah.
Except the money that they took out as fees. And I'm like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What the heck is going on here?
I'll give you the name of my broker when you're done. But I do remember when the recent crash occurred, you know, what was it, 5 years ago now, and my wife kind of freaked out, and I had invested money before, and I said, you know, this is going to be back exactly where it was in, let's say, 5 to 7 years. And I was right.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't freak out. I mean, I was right. We didn't touch anything. It's back right where it was. Because there are these kind of long-term trends. There is a kind of robustness to the system, which I think is lost in this chasing the present moment and checking everything all the time. The highlight reels of your investment is really not what you want to look at. You want to look at long-term performance. It's like your government. You want to look at long-term performance, not that, you know, Barack Obama had two scandals this week, and so his presidency is over. But you know what? His presidency isn't over. that's just not right.
Yeah.
That's not right at
all. Over before it began.
That just isn't right. That's that highlight reel thing, and you're going to be confused by that because they're just large structural elements of life that go on past this sort of flood of data. You just can't, you know, it's like, shouldn't get too upset about it. But so let's move on to the next section of the book, if I can recall correctly. And this is related, and it's how we come to kind of make sense of the whole world without a kind of long timeline. How do we make sense of our life in time? Did I characterize that right?
Yeah. I mean, I call it fractal noia,
which
is maybe it's a convoluted term, but I mean, but we're living in a world where we no longer have really discrete feedback cycles. Like in the old days, you know, if you were a farmer, you know, you would put your seeds, 6 inches apart. 3 months later, you'd see how they grow in, and that's your feedback. And then you can change. You can say, oh, I'm going to put them further apart next time or put them closer together. You have a marketing strategy. You put out an ad. You see a couple months later whether people bought more of your thing or less. And then you can either change the ad or run the same ad or not run any ad at all. No, now, cause and effect are merged. You can't really tell in an instantaneous society what's a cause and what's the effect. Did we just do a marketing program, or are we responding to a tweet, or is the tweet responding to us?
Mm-hmm.
It's like everything is just buzzing by. And what scientists and technologists have used to understand these sort of rapid feedback cycles is usually as fractals. Now you take something like the instead of the screech of a microphone pointing into a speaker, you can use a computer to draw, to slow down, if you will, and draw out that the feedback cycle, these loops, and you get these kind of beautiful paisley drawings that they're of fractals, you know, that most of us now are familiar with, and they're reassuring on a certain level because they have so similarity. This part of the shape is like that. They look like natural things. The danger is when we equate one part of a fractal with another, where we say, oh, this is the same as that, it's the same as that. They're not the same, they're just similar. They have a similar pattern. There's an underlying logic or rhythm to it. It doesn't mean that it's lockstep. It doesn't mean that earthworms are people, are civilizations, are the weather, are the stock market. You know, all these things are similar, but you can't just draw exact conclusions. And really what happens in a society that's living in the exact present tense, that's exactly in the moment, if you don't have a story, if you don't have cause and effect to sort of figure out an underlying logic, you tend to try to draw conclusions based on a static photograph of the moment. You know, you draw lines between things. This is like that is like that. You end up in this kind of almost a paranoid conspiratorial view of the world because everything needs to be connected to everything else in order for things to make sense. Because you no longer have stories, you no longer have history through which to analyze things. Hello?
One of the things that I've noticed is that even when the media tries to explain to people that things are actually happening in the long term, that there are these long-term sort of structural effects, that they don't listen because it takes a little bit of time to explain what those structural effects are. So, for example, when they give long-term averages on the stock market, I don't think people really understand this, and I don't think they really accept it. You see what I mean?
Right. I mean, well, also, also part of the reason they don't accept it is because, you know, past results are no guarantee of the future. You know, there's people, we don't know, even logically, you know, we don't know whether this last 50 years of stock market growth is necessarily, you know, the way the next 50 years plays out. There's often a sense, and that's kind of the last chapter of the book, there's often this sense that things are ending. Mm-hmm. You know, this what I call apocalypto. Mm-hmm. And you know, and throughout history we've almost always felt like we're the last thing, that we're in apocalypse, that something's ending. But you know, in this case it does feel like corporate capitalism and expansionist banking policy may have reached its limit, you know, that we're certainly at the limit of the kind of the globe's capacity to provide more frontiers for expansion. You know, we don't have more territory. There's not more brown peoples that we can enslave and steal their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So exactly where do we expand to?
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't have a place to expand, if we don't have new markets, then how could the economy keep growing the way it's been growing? You know, it kind of can't. So people start to consider various forms of endgame, you know, whether it's the zombie apocalypse in the distant future or the singularity replacing human beings or, you know, some, you know, economic catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't blame people for you know, considering those possibilities.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would say, again, just historically speaking, this is just my opinion, that although I don't necessarily disagree with you, every time somebody has said either capitalism or science has reached a kind of terminus, they've been wrong. Because in each of these cases, and people have said this since the mid-19th century, especially with science.
Right.
You know, we know everything we're going to know, and that's it. You know, I remember I reviewed a book recently that described the way things are. And I'm like, we have no idea the way things are, and more will be revealed. And similarly, I think with you know, economic expansion, there's a lot of room yet for economic expansion. At least I think that there is. But this desire to have an ending, I guess I would think of it in a little bit different way. When I read your chapter about the zombie business, and it's very funny, the zombie business, is that, you know, I think it's a desire for meaning more than anything else. And, you know, my life, now I can see this now, was largely structured, at least in its early years, by the Cold War. I fought communism and I won. You know, I was a Russian historian and the government paid me to become a Russian historian. And I wrote books about Russia and informed people about Russia and said communism was a bad thing. And that gave my life
meaning.
And now I'm like, well, what do I have now? I mean, what do I have? I got to get the next iPhone. That's just not very satisfying. You know, it's just, it doesn't, you know, I don't know what I'm living for now. I just don't see, you know, again, and this sort of harkens back to, we had Francis Fukuyama on the show, you know, he's the end of history. There's something to that. You know, it's like the Chinese are even on board. The Russian are on board with our program. Everybody seems to be, except Hugo Chavez, and he's dead. So, so who is it with our program? And so it kind of makes it, you know, and that's why we just added attention to what is really a small number of Al-Qaeda terrorists. I mean, it really sort of small potatoes compared to, I don't know, Nazi Germany or something. You know, this is just nothing. And so I just think it's kind of a desire for meaning, and there's not a lot of meaning out there, again, in the blizzard of promotional emails I get about, you know, what was the news yesterday? This was big news that, what was it? It was Yahoo bought Tumblr. I mean, why do I care about that? But it was like, that's why do I care? I don't care about that at all. That is not news to me that one big corporation bought another big corporation. I just don't care. But somehow the media cooks this up and that's supposed to give me meaning. It doesn't really work for me very well. How do you see, I mean, I guess, you know, the kind of money question is here. And I know it's a difficult one to ask is this, good for us or bad for us? I mean, you know, again, the obvious answer is both, but go ahead and tackle it.
It depends, you know, it depends. There's good and bad things. I think the good and bad is a dangerous construct, you know, except when we're really talking about, you know, things about which we can have absolute moral conviction. You know, it's bad to put Jews in gas chambers, you know, it's bad. But, you know, when we're talking about cultural change, it's very hard to call it good or bad. You know, I think that the opportunity here is for people to embrace the moment that they're actually living in, to, you know, restore some relationship to Kairos, to human time, to extract themselves from the sort of the hypnotic acceleration of the industrial age and, you know, begin to embrace a much more human peer-to-peer and social relationship to time and one another. On the other hand, if we use this as an opportunity merely to extend the agendas of the industrial age into the digital age, we now have tools that can, dangerously accelerate and exacerbate some of the worst of what we've had in the last century. And I just think it just shows we're now more obligated than ever to seize our agency and to become, you know, the true, you know, programmers and masters of our realm.
Again, I guess, you know, having read your book, one thing that occurred to me, I was reminded of another analogy, and this one is from athletics. There's a Swedish psychologist. I think it was Swedish. I don't remember, but he invented this notion called cold flow. Have you ever heard of this? So this is the state it's kind of a hypnotic state that you enter when you're playing competitive athletics or you're running or something like that. Basically, time stops and you lose orientation. You don't really know where you are because your mind is working in a kind of autonomic way all the time. And I experienced this many times in my own athletic career where I was just unaware of anything except the game because it was all going on so fast. It completely absorbed me. I had my brain could not process anything else. And it just seems to me that increasingly in my life, I feel like that. So much is coming at me all the time that I never have a chance to use a little bit of business jargon, pull up. This is one boss of mine used to say, it's time to pull up, you know, and stop looking at the details and figure out where you are. I just don't feel like people have time to do this anymore because they're too busy checking their email. And there's no notion of, you know, these bigger questions that you ask, you know, why are we here? What are we doing? This other sort of stuff that you have to contemplate and talk to people about is lost in a blizzard of videos of exploding Coke bottles and, you know, highlight reels, you know, it's highlight reels everywhere. It's the best of everything. Cause you know, that's, eventually when you talk about, you know, crowdsourcing, what is crowdsourcing good for? Well, the best thing it's good for is finding the best video of exploding Coke bottles. That's what really it is good for. And I'm not sure that's a good thing by any means. I'm not as hesitant as you are to say good or bad, because, you know, the other thing, there's a lot of interesting things to say about the acquisition yesterday of Tumblr, because it's a weird thing too. And I don't know, I agree with you, Tumblr is a weird thing, but I agree with you in general about this compression of time. It's really quite remarkable how fast it has happened and how we don't really know what it's doing with us. Is it making us sick? I don't think it's making us sick. Is it making us kind of unaware? I definitely think it's making us unaware.
Yeah.
I mean, the job of the historian is now impossible. You know, I have a friend, you know, I study early modern medieval history, and she studies modern history, and she calls what I study the old stuff. I mean, with kind of derision, you know, like, this is a PhD, you know, the old stuff.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you can see how, at least, you know, from my perspective, it's difficult to actually pull up from this stuff and see where you are. I just don't see.
Right.
I don't see how you're going to do it, really. And it, I don't know. It's kind of disturbing to me. So let me ask another question before the final question is, and you just talked about the New York Times book review. How's the book been received?
I think people are embracing this notion that we're living in a kind of a present shock. And I think they really do want to get some tools and ideas on how to orient themselves in this new temporal landscape. So far it's been pretty much universally positive.
Mm-hmm. Nobody's come at you hammer and tong and said, you know, this is anything like that. Nope. Just good, huh?
No.
Yeah. I envy you very much.
No, I haven't seen anything.
I envy you very much.
No.
I really do. And I think thousands of authors all over the world do. So, let me thank you very much for being on the show. Today we've been talking to Douglas Rushkoff about his book, Present Shock. Doug, thanks. And so let me ask you our final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now? Do you have a project in the works?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a documentary for PBS Frontline.
Mm-hmm.
That's tentatively called Generation Like. And I'm looking at, how it's sort of the new landscape on which teens are being marketed to,
mm-hmm.
and trying to figure out, you know, how is it different? How is it the same? And how does it work?
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully they'll produce an app for that, and there'll be some in-app purchases for it, because I know that's breaking me, man. So anyway, today we've been talking with Douglas Rushkoff about Present Shock, when everything happens now. Doug, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. It's what you do.